This is Where We Live from Connecticut Public Radio. I'm Lucy Nalbathanchel. Connecticut is one of the worst areas in the country for people looking for an affordable place to live. It shouldn't surprise anyone that a lack of affordable housing is one of the biggest barriers to truly ending homelessness in the state. Today we talk about this challenge with Richard Cho, the new director of the Connecticut Coalition to End Homelessness. In the last 5 years, during the former Governor Malloy administration, the state has seen chronic homelessness decline by 69%. Overall, homelessness has dropped a quarter over the last decade, but there's still work to do to reach everyone who needs help. And coming up later, we're going to hear how zoning laws in Connecticut towns and cities play a part. You can join us, too. The number 860-275-7266. As always, find us on Facebook and Twitter at Where We Live. I want to welcome Dr. Richard Cho into our studio. Welcome to the show. Congratulations on your new position.
Thank you, and thank you for having me.
I mentioned you're now the CEO of the Connecticut Coalition to End Homelessness. Prior, you worked in New York City, and I'll be curious to hear a little bit about that. But also, you were deputy director at the U.S. Interagency Council on Homelessness during the Obama administration. So you've spent a chunk of your career focused in on housing policy.
Yeah, pretty much all of my career has been focused on housing and homelessness.
And why did you decide to focus in on this?
That's a good question. I mean, I think, to get a little personal, I mean, going back to my roots, my parents were immigrants to this country. They established a home in the city of Chicago. I had an elderly grandmother who also immigrated with us to Chicago. I was the first in my family to be born in the United States. And I think, you know, it made me think a lot about what it means to actually have a home and to be displaced. Even going back further, my parents were, they grew up in what is now North Korea. They moved down to South Korea during the war, and they were refugees themselves. And so for my entire life, I've always thought about what it means to be displaced from a home, and then what it means to actually have a home, and what it takes to actually have a true home for people. And I think that's part of what has inspired me to work in this field.
When we think about housing, it really is a basic necessity to have a roof over your head. And when you don't have stable housing, it has repercussions in your life, whether depending on the place you can choose to live, or the kind of school that you send your children to, your employment opportunities. It's very fundamental to stability to have a place to call home.
Absolutely. I think those of us who have been blessed to actually have a home and never experienced what it's like to be homeless, we may take for granted what it actually means to have a home. It's not just a roof over your head or having a place to store your stuff, but it's also just, you know, how you center your community, where you go to actually have stability. It's so critical to mental health. It's so critical to just our basic daily life. And, you know, I think the healthcare sector is just only now becoming more aware of how much a person's health really is centered around having a stable home and all that comes with that.
Over the last few years, as I mentioned, Connecticut has made significant strides in reducing homelessness. I mentioned chronic homelessness. Can you talk about what that means when we say chronic homelessness, and how Connecticut was able to chip away, actually pretty significantly, the number of people who are chronically homeless?
Yeah. I mean, I think one of the most important developments in the field of ending homelessness over the last maybe 20 years, really, is the realization that homelessness looks different for different people, and we need different strokes for different folks. The idea of chronic homelessness was that there's a subset of people experiencing homelessness who have more severe challenges, more severe disabilities, and where because of those disabilities, they have a harder time resolving homelessness. Homelessness is not a sort of static problem. It's actually a dynamic one. There's new people who fall into homelessness. There's people who resolve their homelessness, and there's people who need help in resolving their homelessness. People experiencing chronic homelessness are those that have those disabilities where without, you know, some kind of intentional help, which usually comes in the form of rental assistance coupled with wraparound services that help them not only find a home but help them keep that home, that's really what it takes to end chronic homelessness. And so there's been a big focus here in Connecticut as well as nationally on trying to focus on that subset and figure out, you know, how do we provide that wraparound services coupled with housing, which we call supportive housing for that population. And then for everybody else, we've been coming up with new strategies and new innovations for how do we help people resolve their homelessness quickly.
You mentioned permanent supportive housing. I was thinking about the goal. Connecticut was, I think, the second state to have supports in place to say that we have ended veteran homelessness in the state. So when Connecticut says that, it doesn't necessarily mean that there will never be another veteran homeless, but explain what that means for Connecticut to say, you know, we've got the supports in place to keep this from happening for this specific population.
Yeah, I mean, I think the simple way to think about it and the way that we defined ending homelessness, and I had a chance to work at the federal level on actually trying to define what it means nationally to end homelessness, and including for veterans. It really means, you know, we know that the challenges of our economic realities mean that people will sometimes lose their homes. But we don't have to accept the fact that that puts them in some kind of permanent situation. The way we think about it is we'll have ended homelessness when we've made it rare. Meaning it only happens in very rare instances, that when it is brief, that we can actually really shorten the length of time that people experience some kind of housing loss or housing crisis, and non-recurring or a one-time experience. Basically, we're going to try to shrink the number of people who fall into homelessness. We're also trying to make that experience as short as possible, meaning we'll help them get connected back to permanent housing as quickly as possible. And we'll make sure they don't come back to homelessness once they're rehoused.
I want to learn more about the supports in specific communities. But again, my guest today is Richard Cho, the new CEO of the Connecticut Coalition to End Homelessness. You can join our conversation, too. You can find us on Facebook and Twitter, at Where We Live. Tell us more about what you did on the federal level.
Yeah, so I came in 2013. It was the beginning of this President Obama's second term. There was a big focus on implementing what had already been created, which was the federal plan to end homelessness, known as Opening Doors. So I had the chance to come in and be one of part of a small team. I worked for the U.S. Interagency Council on Homelessness. We were a tiny federal agency, about 20 people, and our mandate was huge. We were given the task of trying to coordinate 19 different federal departments all row together to really implement the federal plan and achieve an end to homelessness in the country. Really a kind of an incredible honor to serve in that capacity. My job was really to really focus on the Washington, D.C. based policy work. How do we get the federal agencies to contribute their resources, provide policy guidance and direction to really leverage the entire resources that the federal government has at its disposal towards the goal of ending homelessness.
How challenging is it when you talk about multiple federal departments? Often our opinion in the public is that, you know, federal government is just a bureaucracy with many layers and doesn't get a lot done. So explain to me how under the Obama administration you saw this specific progress happening. I mean, how did you do it?
Yeah, I mean, I think so much was already set up when I got there. Having a president and a first lady and the whole White House supporting this effort meant a lot. It just brought all of the agencies to the table at the highest levels of leadership. So I had a chance to work with cabinet level secretaries, agency department heads to really secure their commitment. And that really trickled down to all of the career staff. You know, the bulk majority of the staff in federal agencies are career civil servants. And they do what their job is, but they also take direction from leadership. And so when their cabinet secretary says, we're going to prioritize ending homelessness, it really changes the equation. It changes what they focus on a day-to-day basis. So that sort of priority was already set when I got there. The challenge was really there's so many different cultures. The Federal Department of Health and Human Services, they have a very different culture from the U.S. Department of Housing and Urban Development. VA has a very different culture, and trying to get all those agencies to work across their cultures, some of it was just about translating, really, and helping them understand where each other were coming from. That was a lot of my job, was really brokering those connections, helping to be the system translator. I speak healthcare, but I also speak housing. I learned a lot about how the Veterans Affairs Department works as well.
You mentioned Opening Doors, and this is something that Connecticut was able to use to help change what the face of homelessness looks like in our state. So how in the sense did that happen? I mean, obviously federal dollars is important to support the work, but to ensure that the money going to specific communities is being used wisely.
Yeah, I mean, Connecticut was you know, when I was at the federal government, we didn't have favorites per se, but we did really like what was happening in Connecticut, and one of the reasons was because they aligned Connecticut has aligned its statewide plan to end homelessness based on the federal plan Opening Doors. So there was an Opening Doors Connecticut plan. When we issued guidance or direction on how to set priorities, how to use federal dollars in smarter ways to be more efficient in prioritizing certain populations over others, Connecticut always fell in line and followed that guidance. When we actually created a definition for what it means to end veteran homelessness, when First Lady Michelle Obama put out a challenge to all mayors, county leaders, and governors across the country to commit to ending veteran homelessness, Connecticut was one of the first states to raise their hand, and Governor Malloy in particular said that he would get it done. And so it was always fantastic working with Connecticut and having Connecticut really align itself with the federal efforts to end homelessness.
So how does your focus, your work change now as the new leader of the Connecticut Coalition to End Homelessness because you've worked on the federal level? So tell us about the work that you're doing within this organization now.
Yeah, boy. I mean, I at the federal level, it's one thing to talk about the kind of policy directions that should take place. It's a whole other thing to actually implement them. You know, at the federal level, my job was to really you know, not only coordinate across federal agencies, but provide communities with what the direction should be. And a lot of that was around this idea of housing first. That one of the most important things that we've learned about ending homelessness is that, you know, people have mental health challenges, they have addiction issues, they have a lack of employment. But fundamentally, how do you end homelessness is to give people housing. It sounds kind of intuitive, but it took the field 20 years to get to that realization of that housing first, and then using that housing as a platform to help people address their other issues. You know, now that I'm in Connecticut, now I'm faced with the task of how do you actually implement that? What does that look like? And that gets down to operational issues. Like, how do you help people who are actually in immediate need? What do you do for them? Who do they call? How do they get assistance? Those are the questions that we're now grappling with.
We're a small state, but there are 169 towns, cities, hamlets, and I'm curious, with all of the different nonprofits within certain parts of the state, I think the term, the acronym was CAND. Can you describe how all of these organizations are working? So if they hear someone is homeless, say in Middlesex County, how they can get them into a place?
Yeah, great question. I think this has been one of the game-changing things for our efforts to end homelessness in Connecticut. It used to be that if you're homeless, you didn't know where to go for help. You would hear from word on the street that there might be a shelter open or there might be housing programs that you could apply for. But you know, a person experiencing homelessness facing that immediate crisis would actually have to figure out how to navigate all those different systems. They often had to apply to 20 different programs to try to get help, be on 20 different waiting lists for housing. We've changed all that over the last several years here in Connecticut through the creation of these coordinated access networks, or CANs as we call it for short, where we've organized the set of homeless service providers across the state into these regions, these coordinated access regions, where within those regions there's a central point of intake. If anyone's experiencing homelessness, they can call the state's 211 system, who then connects them to the regional CAN. Then the CAN actually has a uniform set of assessments to actually determine who needs help the most and what type of help that they can provide. And now we're actually able to look at data on not only who's calling for help, but how quickly are we able to get them help, how are we matching them to the right types of housing and services, and how quickly are we able to resolve homelessness. It's created not only a kind of coordination across the state, but also created new levels of accountability where the nonprofit sector, we used to be able to say, we may be serving this person or not, and nobody actually knew who was serving them. We can actually say who's accountable for serving Richard Cho, who's in need of housing assistance, and where is he on the waiting list, and how quickly are we moving him into housing.
Richard Cho is in studio with me. He's the new CEO of the Connecticut Coalition to End Homelessness. We were talking about Connecticut's success in ending veteran homelessness. So what did Connecticut need to have in place to get to that goal? And how does that then influence how you're looking at other populations in the state who are homeless?
Yeah, we're modeling all of our efforts on the strategy that we used to end veteran homelessness, where we were incredibly successful. You know, veteran homelessness is one area where, it was sort of a perfect alignment of stars. You had congressional support within Congress who provided new federal resources to end veteran homelessness in ways that they've never done for other populations. You have a system in the federal VA that's accountable for the outcomes for veterans. But even with those resources and with the VA being on the hook to try to end veteran homelessness, we weren't seeing communities really achieve that goal. When the First Lady Michelle Obama launched the Mayor's Challenge to End Veteran Homelessness, the idea was, you know, how do we engage jurisdictional leaders, governors and mayors, to actually commit to this goal? And when it was that Governor Malloy actually raised his hand and said he would join this challenge to end veteran homelessness in Connecticut, it really rallied all of the partners and it kicked everything into high gear. So all the providers, organizations, the organization I now lead, CCH, you know, we all got together to look at how are we doing in terms of keeping veteran homelessness rare, brief, and non-recurring, and using performance metrics to really drive an end to veteran homelessness. And that's what we've done. We've created a system where we're not only identifying veterans immediately who become homeless, but we're actually able to provide them with either short-term assistance in the form of rapid rehousing or permanent supportive housing or other types of interventions to help veterans resolve their homelessness as quickly as possible. Mm-hmm. You know, trying to get that the time that they spend homeless down to something like 60 days, 45 days. Mm.
When I was thinking about how the federal government in the last few years has really prioritized meeting the needs of veterans, and so it's helpful when HUD is able to allocate more housing vouchers for a specific community to house veterans. But what about other vulnerable populations, families, or I'm just curious, you know, how you know, certain, it appears that, you know, there's kind of like a priority list in a way.
That's
and
right.
So for the people that are kind of lower on the priority list to be able to also access these vouchers to find housing.
Yeah, I mean, and we're trying to recreate the kind of resources we have for veterans for other populations. Unfortunately, there hasn't been the kind of political support to provide dedicated housing and services resources for families with children who are homeless, or youth and young adults who are homeless, or people with disabilities. But we're trying to recreate that and patch that together through a variety of state and federal resources. And I'd say that the challenge with that is, with having the political support around veterans, you have that kind of public sympathy. And I think that what we would hope to see is that our having ended veteran homelessness serves as a proof point to show that we can actually end homelessness. We don't have to accept the fact that homelessness is a reality. It's something that's just fixed in the landscape. And if we can actually do this by leveraging other resources in the other sectors, we could do this for all populations.
Richard Cho is the new CEO of the Connecticut Coalition to End Homelessness. He's here with me, Lucy Nalpathanchil, on Where We Live. Before coming into this new Connecticut role, Cho was a deputy director at the U.S. Interagency Council on Homelessness during the Obama administration. Coming up after the break, we're going to talk more about efforts to support all different populations here in Connecticut. And you can join us, too. Find us on Facebook and Twitter at Where We Live. And here's our studio number, 860-275-7255. This is Where We Live from Connecticut Public Radio. I'm Lucy Nalpathanchil. Today I'm talking with Richard Cho, the new CEO of the Connecticut Coalition to End Homelessness. We've been talking again about the progress in the state, Richard, but there was that report, the federal report earlier, I think it was actually late last year, that found that actually Connecticut did see a spike in the number of homeless individuals in Connecticut in 2018. And why was that, and what's been done?
Yeah, thank you for asking about that. You know, we actually, every year in January, conduct an annual count of the number of people experiencing homelessness. It's called the point in time count. And in fact, we'll be doing that again this year on January 22nd. We're looking for volunteers, so definitely would love to see more people come out to help us canvass the streets and actually get an accurate count. And that provides a comparison of how we're doing year to year. And it's the one measure we have that is consistent with how other communities measure homelessness. So while it doesn't provide a picture of all homelessness, it gives us that one-night snapshot that enables us to say, how are we doing from year to year, and as well as how is Connecticut compared to other states? You know, we found in the January 2018 point-in-time count that the number of people experiencing homelessness on that single night was 3,383. We also had a situation where in the aftermath of Hurricane Maria, a number of people were evacuated by FEMA to the state of Connecticut. and where there was an emergency sheltering program provided, putting many people into hotels or motels on a temporary basis. And we were required by the federal government to make sure that we report anybody who's in a temporary housing situation who's experiencing homelessness. We made sure to distinguish that number. It was about close to 600 people who had been evacuated from Hurricane Maria and were in that emergency sheltering program. So when HUD put out their report, and often takes them many months to actually put out their final report and aggregate all the numbers that they get from the state, they put out the total number, and they didn't disaggregate the Hurricane Maria evacuees from the other people who are experiencing homelessness in Connecticut. So the number that we report is that it was 3,383 people experiencing homelessness on that single night, which was relative, which was pretty much flat from 2017. We didn't see a significant year-to-year decrease. But I want to make it clear, that spike was really about that Hurricane Maria evacuee sheltering program.
Can I ask if there was, if the federal government hadn't responded with resources eventually, because we have a large Puerto Rican population in the state of Connecticut, what would have Connecticut done?
Yeah, I think what we would have seen is that many of them, you know, and many individuals did end up doubled up with their family members, but many probably without having that kind of FEMA assistance would have probably ended up in our regular emergency shelter system, which would have created significant problems. You know, we would have had a shortage of shelter beds. We already have, you know, often not enough shelter capacity in our state to help alleviate the immediate crisis of homelessness for people. But you could just imagine how much more flooded that system would have been when we, you know, shelter providers were trying to respond to people who've been displaced from their homes due to a storm, but as well as people who've been displaced for other reasons here in the state of Connecticut.
You can join our conversation, 860-275-7266. Mario is calling from Bristol. Mario, go ahead.
Yes, hi. Thanks for taking my call. I just wanted to comment here. I was homeless once, and I just wanted to briefly, I'll be as quick as I could, talk about that for a moment, because I understand what Mr. Chow is talking about has a lot of advantages. And I kind of think that the experience that I had maybe might add to some of that. Okay, so I came out here in 1969 to go to college. My aid failed to come through. So I was booted off campus, and all of a sudden I find myself in a town that I knew nothing about because I was coming from another state. And I'm there, well, I'm not going to go home. Okay, that was out. Okay. And so, but I was homeless. I was living in a park under a bush, okay, in the evenings, cleaning down at the stream. But one thing that I figured out was I had to get out of this situation real fast. Okay. And it took time to get out of it. But I figured, well, what was I going to do? You know, and one thing I figured out was back then, they had community grocery stores where you worked in exchange for food, okay? In order for me to do that, you know, I had to change my clothes, you know, versus looking like a street drag, okay? Shave down at the stream and try to make myself look and appear normal so that I could interact. And you have to have a certain drive. Mm. I see that a lot of homeless people don't have any esteem. They think they're lowlifes, and they have psychological and health problems that hold them back. And a lot of people just don't trust them.
Mario, can I ask what helped you then find a place to live eventually?
Okay. This is another part of the strategy that I had, besides figuring out how to get food through the community centers, was I had to find a place that wasn't normal, like, say, a third-floor apartment in a home where a lady or family was renting out, okay? Because back then you could get a rent for, like, $26 a week or a month sometimes, okay, just because the families trusted you. So I start going to the local health food stores where they had bulletin boards looking for apartments for rent, okay, rooms for rent. And then I had to convince these people that was trustworthy enough to live there. Mm. And for that, I needed a job. And even that was tough.
So, Mario, you keep talking about back then, so I'm curious from, you know, still living in Connecticut, I'm hearing about different approaches to ending homelessness. Are policy leaders on the right track, or what can they do more to help people who find themselves homeless?
Well, the reason why I wanted to start this scenario about myself was to show that facilities are needed. A person has to be able to, first of all, have the confidence and the esteem to walk into a facility and say, I need help. And if those facilities aren't there, then guess what? That person continues to be homeless. And that's where the support from the government and the communities come in. And that's one of the lacking prospects that a person facing homelessness has. Now, I became successful. I put my kids through college. I own my home. It's paid off. I did rather well, okay? I was a builder, a residential carpenter. And once a person loses grip of their own reality that they have no security, they're done.
Yeah. Well, Mario,
that's where these facilities come in.
We thank you for calling, and we're glad to hear that you're doing well. I wanted Richard Cho to respond to your story because I think introduces the next question I have, which is perceptions that community has about people who are homeless and some of the barriers, simple things we may take for granted that can help someone get a foot in the door and a chance of finding a job and stable housing.
Yeah, thank you. I mean, I actually really appreciate Mario's call because his story illustrates what we've seen with a lot of people experiencing homelessness, which is, you know, there's this public perception that people are, you know, I'd say like lazy, that they're doing it to themselves, that they're choosing to be homeless. Mario shows that, you know, it can happen to a lot of people, even those who have drive and ambition and who are trying to work, right? The difficult circumstances happen. And that's what we see with the vast majority of people experiencing homelessness. Many of them are working. Many of them are really trying to get back into the on their feet. But, you know, it's not easy to find a job. It's not easy to find housing. It's certainly not easy to have, again, many of them are working, but have enough housing, enough income to afford housing on this market. And, you know, I don't know exactly when Mario experienced homelessness himself, but back then the cost of housing was nowhere near what it is today. I think his story perfectly illustrates what we've seen. What we've been doing as the homelessness service system in Connecticut is really trying to create a situation where for the vast majority of people experiencing homelessness who have that drive, ambition, who are already working, you know, how do we not have to make them run around and navigate these systems on their own, but how do we do that faster for them? And how do we provide them with that little bit of help to help them get back on their feet? Again, there are people with disabilities who need more than that. But for the many, many people, I think it's really about helping them do what Mario did, but faster, not having to run around in circles.
Let's talk about cost, because you brought it up, and it's a really important part of our conversation this hour, and the fact that Connecticut is a very expensive state. Research and studies have shown that you have to make $24 an hour to afford a two-bedroom apartment in the state, and that is not attainable for a lot of people. So how do we make it more affordable, and what are some of the challenges, Richard?
Yeah, I mean, that's challenging. You know, we have a dynamic in Connecticut, kind of the perfect storm, frankly, where we have huge, income inequalities in the state of Connecticut. And we have a housing market that isn't responsive to the demand that's out there at all levels of the market. We have a housing market that tends to respond more to people who are, speculating on the private market or have multiple homes, and or people have their own single family home and a second home, or where they're using their home to rent it out for Airbnb and things like that. So our market is not keeping up with what the housing needs are, certainly, and so we have the cost of housing that is far outpacing what anybody can afford. I mean, we could have people work 200 hours a week at a minimum wage, they still wouldn't be able to afford a one bedroom apartment in the state of Connecticut. So I think that's what we'll see. You know, we could reach the point, and we're getting close to this, where we could have the most efficient rehousing system in the state of Connecticut. Anybody falls into homelessness, we could provide them with a variety of types of assistance to get them back into housing within 30 to 45 days. But in some ways, it feels like we're bailing out a sinking ship if we don't stop the inflow of people. Right now, on any given month, and now we have real-time data that can tell us this, About 200 people are resolving their homelessness every month. We're helping people exit homelessness through a variety of types of assistance into housing. But another 200 people are coming into homelessness. And that is really a function of the housing market. And so I think we'll do more and we'll continue to work hard to try to rehouse and help people resolve homelessness. But we have to figure out how do we stop that housing displacement from happening in the first place.
You've mentioned providing people assistance a few times, and I'm curious, what happens to the person who has a good-paying job, and then one day they may lose that job, but they still have a mortgage to pay, children, food to put on the table, education costs. When we talk about assistance, are people, cut out from that if they, you know, were making a certain wage versus someone who's within a certain poverty line?
Yeah, I mean, we have programs like Rapid Rehousing, Rapid Exits now. We have a program. We're also doing some work to divert people from shelter. Because we've created this state 2-in-1 system that serves as the one single point of intake for any kind of homeless assistance or housing assistance, anybody who is seeking shelter can call 2-in-1. And so now we actually are able to identify families who are on the brink of homelessness. And so we've been able to through a project called Be Homeful, raise some private dollars to create a shelter diversion fund that enables us to provide that emergency assistance to families who are on the brink of homelessness and before they even have to come to homeless shelters. And I think the question is really, how do we sustain and grow that? There was a bipartisan housing commission that took place several years ago, and they issued a report. And basically, their job was to figure out what does America's housing system look like. Two of the recommendations was that any family who's experiencing homelessness should get rental assistance. But they also said that we should create an emergency fund for families who lose their job or fall behind in their mortgage payments or their rent payments or are at risk of eviction that can help them with that resolution. And I think that's kind of the vision of what we're trying to create in Connecticut, is a system where we can provide that emergency assistance for any family who's on the brink of homelessness to stop that inflow into the system.
Mm-hmm. We've talked about veteran homelessness. You mentioned ways to help families dealing with homelessness. But what about specific to youth for whatever reason are finding that they're living on the streets by themselves? What is Connecticut doing to address youth homelessness? And who are the youth most at risk?
Yeah, that's a great question. You know, we conducted a study. One of the challenges with youth is that they don't experience homelessness in the same ways. They don't show up at adult homeless shelters. They don't tend to live outside on the streets. What they'll do is find other situations mostly where they're couch surfing. They'll move around from either their friends family or friends house to house until they burn out of options, run out of options. Many of the youth also are fleeing domestic violence or abusive situations, or in some cases family conflict because of their sexual orientation. So many youth and young adults are LGBTQ, and they're leaving their homes because of that family conflict. One of the challenges with ending youth homelessness is even finding those youth, because they're not showing up at the same places where adults and older people who experience homelessness show up. And so a lot of what our work is about is trying to get all the various places, schools, community organizations where you can actually find youth and young adults who are experiencing homelessness to better identify youth who may not even themselves identify with the term homelessness, but who are certainly homeless. We also recently won a $6.5 million award from HUD, where they're funding a youth homelessness demonstration program. And that's really enabling us to create, again, the same types of programs that we've had for veterans, that we've been creating for families and for individuals, for youth and young adults. So we're creating longer-term housing options, as well as rapid rehousing, rapid exit, and shelter diversion programs for youth as well.
I wanted to ask you, when we talk about the federal government, again, you worked under the Obama administration, but now under the Trump administration, how any support, has it changed at all for communities related to the federal dollars that are going to provide for housing assistance or rental assistance?
Yeah, I mean, that's actually more of a complicated story than you think. Certainly, homelessness is not a priority for the current administration in Washington as it was under the Obama administration. You don't have the White House probably asking as much about how we're doing on our efforts to end homelessness. On the other hand, when I was at the federal government, we continued to push for more resources. Even in a time of sequestration, I joined the administration in 2013. And we were under sequestration budget. So agencies were being asked to give a 5% cut across the board. And even then, we tried to push Congress to provide more resources to end homelessness. And with a split Congress at that time, we didn't get those resources. Ironically, in the last couple of years, with the various CRs that have been passed, there have been more dollars for homeless assistance grants as the Republicans have asked for more defense spending. Democrats have asked for more discretionary spending for programs. We've gotten some increases. So actually, there has been some more funding. That said, it's been certainly more difficult to get the kind of guidance and direction that we want from the federal government to really help engage communities. But, you know, I don't see Connecticut taking its foot off the pedal in any way. We are still driving forward with the goals of ending homelessness, particularly to end family and youth homelessness by the year 2020.
This is Where We Live. I'm Lucy Nalpathanchil. In studio with me is Dr. Richard Cho, new CEO of the Connecticut Coalition to End Homelessness. We're going to continue our conversation after the break, and we're going to explore the barriers still in the state of Connecticut that prevent more affordable housing in communities across the state. You can join our conversation 860-275-7266. Find us on Facebook and Twitter at Where We Live. This is Where We Live. I'm Lucy Nalpathanchil. We've been focusing in on how the state can continue to reduce homelessness. In studio with me is Richard Cho, new CEO of the Connecticut Coalition to End Homelessness. Now, we briefly touched on the issue of affordable housing in Connecticut. And when we think about affordable housing, one of the barriers is the access to affordable housing in communities. And communities are the ones that come up with zoning laws. And so joining our conversation now is Fanula Darby Hutchins, Community Education and Outreach Coordinator for the Connecticut Fair Housing Center. Fanula, welcome to our show.
Thank you so much, Lucy, for having me.
So let's talk about affordable housing in the state. How much do we have and how much do we need?
Clearly, we do not have enough. Ideally, we would like every community in Connecticut to have a minimum of 10% of their housing stock to be considered affordable based on sort of the median income of the area. So that affordable housing is going to look different across every region in the state. However, it is an extremely low number of communities that have that affordable housing, and that affordable housing is concentrated in our urban areas and in the areas that you think it would be in: New Haven, Hartford, New London, Groton, Stamford, exactly. So that's sort of where we're at with that.
So in the suburbs, so to speak, what are some of the barriers to getting 10% of housing to be affordable?
I'd say first and foremost, it's exclusionary zoning. And before I kind of dive into what exclusionary zoning is and how that's controlled at a local level, I think it's really important that we frame this as a civil rights issue. So our state is extremely racially segregated and is one of the most racially segregated states in the country. And that is absolutely a result of exclusionary zoning. So in several suburban communities that are predominantly white communities, we have zoning policy that does not allow for a variety of housing types, which means that if a zoning ordinance suggests we only permit single-family housing in this community, that is going to limit an entire population of people from even accessing that community.
So, Richard, if you could talk a little bit about this disparity, this lack of multifamily apartments in suburbs, and what can be done when we have a state that it's very decentralized and local towns have a lot of control in what kind of development they even allow in their towns.
Yeah, I think it's a great question. It's not only a lack of multifamily housing development that's allowed because of zoning and because of density restrictions. It's also a function that, you know, a lot of developers aren't incented to create housing at the lowest end of the market, which is really what people experiencing homelessness need, is housing that's affordable to people who are earning what we call 30% or below of area median income. A lot of the affordable housing that's created is still for people who are earning fairly moderate incomes. And so when we say affordable housing, I think we need to be clear about what we mean as well. I happen to have the chance to serve on the Lamont Transition Team's Housing Policy Committee. And that was a question that the committee was really grappling with, was how do we just increase the amount of development that's happening of housing in general, but also in particular multifamily rental housing and also housing that is affordable across all income spectrums. And, you know, I think there were a variety of different strategies created, but a lot that is about how do we leverage and create incentives for towns and communities as well as developers to be able to increase the amount of development. It doesn't feel like we're pushing on all fronts to be able to really increase the amount of development that needs to happen in the state.
Under the Malloy administration, the Connecticut Mirror reported that the private sector has invested about $2 billion in new affordable housing developments since 2013. But when we think about those developments, they're mixed income, mixed use developments, also includes market rate units. And so there's a limit of how many of those units can be affordable, Fanula.
Right. And I think also a lot of that affordable housing development has really focused on studio apartments, one-bedroom apartments, and even two-bedroom apartments in some cases. And that does not address some of the chronic homelessness that we have seen in the state, and specifically family homelessness. Furthermore, it doesn't address some of the systemic housing discrimination we see. Discrimination based on familial status is extremely high. So if there's less units available to house a family, plus a barrier of housing discrimination, ending familial homelessness is going to be to continue to be a challenge. And so that affordable housing development has not been necessarily geared for families.
You can join our conversation, 860-275-7266. Sherry is calling from Plainville. Sherry, go ahead with your comment or question.
Hi, can you hear me?
Yes, go ahead.
Hi. I am a landlord in New Britain and have been for about the past 7 years. And the main issue that we see, New Britain is probably the cheapest housing in the whole state of Connecticut. You can get a two-bedroom apartment for $850 a month, which a household with two adults working full-time minimum wage can afford. But the problem that we have seen with the agencies that assist people who are homeless in getting rehoused is that inevitably the people who they are bringing have mental health issues that have caused the homelessness in the first place. And always within a year of them moving in, they have problems that cause us to have to evict them. They stop paying the rent and the agency is gone. They menace the other residents of the multifamily building and we have to evict them. They menace us and we have to evict them. To the point where we idealistically have said for many years, yes, we need to work with these agencies, we need to help with this, but we've gotten to the point where we've realized since every single time mental health or personality issues have made it impossible to house these people. And they're all families because we don't have any units that are smaller than two bedrooms, and most of our units are three and four bedrooms.
Well, Sherry, so what's your question for our guests? Do you think that that kind of assistance that gets a tenant there in the first place needs to continue longer?
Yes, we need the agency to be there providing services for the tenant. Basically, they're going to need it for the rest of their tenancies. Because they lose their housing. The reason they lost their housing in the first place was because of their mental health or personality issues or their criminal behavior.
Well, Sherry, I want to give our guests a chance to respond to what you have said. Richard, go ahead.
Yeah, Sherry, I'm sorry that has been your experience. You know, what we've been trying to set up in Connecticut with all the nonprofits that we're partnering with is where in some cases we are helping families to find housing on the private market and work with landlords such as yourself to help them get into housing. The goal is not to drop them off and then say goodbye and never leave and never say, you know, check in again. There really should be a connection so that if that individual family is actually experiencing a crisis again, they know how to call and get connected back to the community. Again, there's no way to force people to do that, but on a voluntary basis. But also where we pride our relationship with landlords such that we want to make sure that there is a number to call if you are experiencing those situations. So it doesn't have to get to an eviction, but we can help resolve those situations, either help with rent arrears or help with money management or what, or provide more mental health services if that is the case. But I want to be clear, you know, that not everybody experiencing homelessness does have those mental health issues. And so I don't want to paint a picture where we're saying everybody who's experiencing homelessness has a mental health issue. Many of them don't. But for those that do, I think it is critical that we connect them with mental health services. And that is the model that we're trying to create. If that's not what's happening, I certainly would love to know about it.
Fanola Darby Hudgens is also here with us. Besides Richard Cho, who we just heard, you're with the Connecticut Fair Housing Center. When we hear about evictions, can you talk through how detrimental that is to get to that point for the tenant as well as the landlord, and ways to provide people with stable housing no matter their circumstance?
Right. So in Connecticut and across the country, and as Matthew Desmond so beautifully illustrated in his book Evicted, evictions disproportionately affect female-headed households of color. Evictions are disproportionately in our divested urban cores. And so the eviction... The way housing discrimination works that leads to eviction is a systemic cause of homelessness. And eviction is directly a systemic cause of housing discrimination.
We were talking earlier about how zoning laws are keeping more affordable units from being built or available in the state. So what can be done, Fanola? We only have about 5 minutes, but this is an important topic that we wanted to talk about.
Sure. In our office, in our little fair housing world, I am known as the person who believes we can change hearts and minds. And so I believe really quality community education and really quality outreach efforts can inform our work. I also believe strongly in legislative advocacy. We worked really hard pushing an inclusionary zoning bill through session last year. I think we'll see that bill come up again this year. We have the Legislative Fair Housing Task Force working on this. We have the Affordable Housing Task Force in New Haven. We have the Reentry Task Force, which just closed and will have legislative recommendations. So I think the work is happening, and I think we can continue to do so. And I think outreach really needs to inform our efforts. I was in the greater Stamford area last weekend, and I learned that it is impossible for low and moderate income families to get year-long leases. And really, the reason for that is rapid gentrification, which is a result of exclusionary zoning, right? So as a result of gentrification, landlords are quickly raising rents, and they don't want 12-month leases because they can't raise the rents, and then these families can no longer afford their housing, so they're evicted for lapse of time, or they're evicted because their lease has come done.
You mentioned inclusionary zoning law that did not go through the General Assembly last year. And why is that? Is there a portion of communities that have the NIMBYism that they don't want these units in their town?
Absolutely. Yes. Absolutely. To answer your question simply, yes. The NIMBYism is extremely prevalent across the state, unfortunately. And I think that it really is a result of our own implicit biases, our own fears, and our systemic segregation. If we don't work to integrate our communities, we're never going to undo some of our own implicit biases.
Richard Cho, again, we're almost out of time. But how, in your new role as CEO of the Connecticut Coalition to End Homelessness, how do you tackle these barriers that still remain in Connecticut?
I think what Fanula was mentioning, just in terms of education, I think we have a lot of work to do to try to destigmatize poverty and homelessness, and help people understand what the face of homelessness is like. So that's certainly part of it, and to also help communities understand that affordable housing, supportive housing, these kind of resources are an asset to the community. They actually help, and to take them to show them examples of supportive housing and affordable housing developments that have been effective and transformative for communities and neighborhoods. And that actually contribute to economic growth. I think that's a big part of it. The other thing I want to say is just, you know, we have done a lot in the homelessness service system to try to streamline and create a centralized point of access for services and understand how to deliver housing assistance in a more efficient way. The affordable housing sector in and of itself doesn't have that. There's a long way to go to even know how many units we have, where they are, and how people apply. People still have to apply to many different programs, waiting lists to obtain affordable housing. I think we need to create the same kind of coordinated system on the affordable housing side as we have done for homeless assistance.
Well, I want to thank Dr. Richard Cho again, who's the new leader at the Connecticut Coalition to End Homelessness. Thanks for joining us today.
Thank you so much for having me.
Also, Fanula Darby Hudgens, Community Education and Outreach Coordinator for the Connecticut Fair Housing Center. We'll talk about this again. We hope to have you back.
Thank you so much, Lucy.
Today's show produced by Carmen Baskoff. Thanks to Kion Wolf and Lydia Brown. Learn more about the show, wmpr.org/where we live. I'm Lucy Nalpathanchil. Thanks for listening.